What is going on, guys? This is Brendan Burns, and welcome to the Brendan Burns Show. Join me as I interview, dissect, and share the stories of high performers who have created the life that they deserve on their terms. I sit down with speakers, professional athletes, and successful entrepreneurs from all over the world who have chosen to live a life of fulfillment and joy over status and money. In each episode, I share actionable strategies that you can implement in your life, plus inspiration along the way. So come join me for this episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. Joining us today is Mike Loeffler. Mike is recovered from substance abuse, alcoholism, and codependency. And since recovery and gaining freedom in his life, Mike is a friend, leader in his community, and married to his wife, Alyssa. And they now have and share a dog named Moses. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Brendan. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man. It's great to have you here. I think one of the first times we connected, I actually heard you speak at a recovery meeting and kind of tell your story a little bit. So would love to kind of hear that sort of from the beginning for the listeners to catch up on kind of who you are and what your path has been to where you are today.
Yeah, of course. It's actually funny you mentioned that. I remember my very first meeting at Awaken Recovery, you spoke. And I remember your message on Little Foxes. And that was my first time experiencing recovery from anything outside of a substance abuse, you know, disorder mentality. And it was so inspirational for me and how I found, you know, the next couple of years of my healing journey.
Nice, man. Yeah. One of the things I really like about our recovery program in San Diego is it's technically 12-step oriented, but it's beyond alcoholism and substance abuse because, you know, thank God that wasn't something that I had to navigate. But, you know, for so many people, even who have kind of the background with alcoholism, like we were just talking about, you said, right, pretty much everyone with alcoholism or substance abuse has codependency, love addiction, sex addiction, or an addiction on some level, right? That's one of the things I love about our program is we can kind of tackle what's underneath the addiction or just go straight to it if you don't have kind of that alcoholism.
Yeah, absolutely. And that actually is a good segue kind of into my story. You know, a lot of those exterior issues, you know, separate from, you know, drug addiction, alcoholism, and everything that goes along with it are a lot of the reasons why I got into that lifestyle in the first place. You know, growing up as a young boy with, you know, emotional disorders, abandonment trauma, you know, just living that experience, a lot of the issues that I, you know, struggled with that predated substance abuse and drinking, you know, are a lot of the reasons that I had to seek out Awaken Recovery in the first place, which is that even at a year clean, you know, my life was still a mess. I was still living in chaos. I had still had a lot of internal struggles with who I was, where I was going, and the way that my life was. You know, growing up, I was very, very lucky. I had, you know, two very loving parents that raised me the best way they possibly could. I was adopted at 9 months. Both of my birth parents were never married. They both struggled with substance abuse disorder. You know, they still struggle with it to this day. And, you know, I think a lot of that, it just took a while for that to finally catch up in my life. When I was, you know, a young boy growing up, I, you know, struggled in school. I struggled with, you know, social anxiety, depression. And, you know, a lot of those behavioral issues made it very, very hard for me to connect with the people around me. And, you know, in that sense, you know, I think when I started drinking and started using, it was really just kind of a longing for me to, you know, experience something that the people around me were experiencing and really just gain social connection with people. You know, growing up into high school years, it was very much, you know, the quote unquote cool, but, you know, really not cool thing to do would be to, you know, go out with all the other teenagers and get drunk in a public park somewhere, someone's house if they were out of town, and, you know, really just kind of let loose and, you know, be the person that, you know, I thought that everyone else wanted me to be.
Yeah, I like to quote, the opposite of addiction is connection. And I had a similar story where I felt very kind of lost and isolated growing up. And then the addiction helped me meet those needs. Or either alone, I felt more something, or I would get out there and I could actually talk to people if I was 5 to 10 beers deep.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the second that you are inhibited by a substance, like those social walls just kind of come tumbling down. I think for me, especially when I was drinking, you know, a lot of the social behaviors or the social mannerisms, I think that I was afraid of because I didn't want to embarrass myself or come off too strong. I think that even just having alcohol in my system, like I was like, even if I make a mistake, I can just backtrack and say, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, I was drunk.
Right.
You know? And you know, I had a couple of experiences growing up, you know, that I won't really get into depth on this show with it just for the sake of time. But, you know, because of those things, also I used alcohol and, you know, drugs to really just numb out some of that trauma that I, you know, was slowly coming to terms with as kind of an adolescent, you know, young adult. And, you know, not having that social connection in my life, it made it very difficult for me to kind of go through the natural steps to deal with, you know, problems in our life or traumas. And, you know, like right now, like if I had an issue, I would take it to my community.
Yeah.
You know, I would take it to, you know, one of our pastors. I would take it to one of my friends and we would just talk through it like two, you know, normal, healthy human beings,
right.
You know, the way that, you know, the way that you should really deal with anything that happens in life. You know, if I have a bad day at work, I just tell my wife and we talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, but back then I didn't have that social connection. I didn't have, you know, that healthy way to process through what I was dealing with. And, you know, so instead of going to, you know, the friends that I really didn't have, you know, I would just get home from school, steal a bottle of alcohol out of my dad's liquor cabinet and just get drunk in my room. And, you know, that's definitely not a healthy way to deal with your emotions.
It's not.
Absolutely not. Yeah. No. You know, and it's funny that we joke about this, but the problem with it is that even though it's not healthy, you know, it is effective.
Right.
You know, for a very long time, you know, using drugs and, you know, drinking to the point of blackout, you know, from the age of 12. You know, I got blackout drunk for the first time at, you know, 12 years old. I was, you know, smoking weed and, you know, it really started turning from, you know, a social activity to like, oh my gosh, like I realized that this is actually working for this area in my life that I can't bring into social situations. And, you know, the problem with that is that at some point you realize that it's not enough, you know, and it's kind of like that age old adage that like you can never relive that first high. You know, it got to the point for me where, you know, half a bottle of whiskey just wasn't cutting it anymore.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, doing cocaine for 4 hours just wasn't enough anymore. And you realize that, you know, you wake up the next morning or you wake up 3 days later and, you know, those problems are still there. So
one of my old coaches that used to kind of help me through addiction when I was quitting pornography, you always used to say, you can never have enough of what won't truly satisfy you.
That's good. Yeah. I think that the problem is that there's a difference between, you know, worldly satisfaction and like spiritual satisfaction, like sex, porn, drugs, alcohol, you know, whatever it is that we use. You know, it does make us happy for a little bit. Like you do have kind of that elation, that high, that kind of that smooth feeling that you get when, you know, you're kind of just on top of the world for, you know, 15 minutes or an hour or a day. And, you know, I have to say I've lived it both ways and nothing compares to the absolute joy that comes from living like a clean and healthy life.
100%. Yeah. why are you rolling your eyes?
No, I just the mic was cutting.
Oh, okay.
I was like getting really close to the microphone.
Yeah, you gotta kiss it, man. All right. So, when did you realize that this was a problem that you needed to do something about?
Yeah, I think for me, when I started using drugs, initially, obviously growing up as the child of two parents that struggled with substance abuse, both of my parents were very, very smart to let me know kind of where I'd come from and the things that my parents struggled with, like addiction and alcoholism are diseases. They're medically recognized genetic disorders that can be passed down from, parents to their children to their children. And, they basically, from the age where I could understand it, had always told me, hey, this is how your parents were. You need to be very, very cautious. Really just trying to look out for me. But the problem with that was, is that from a very, very young age, the title of addict or like kind of that identity was being spoken over me. So it was almost like this, this expectation that I was going to be the same way that my parents were. So I really think that from the first time that I used narcotics, like I immediately knew that it was going to become a problem. I don't think that I was at a point where I'd ever had a bad experience with it. So I didn't really, I think, care, for lack of a better phrase. I remember that like the first time that I ever used cocaine, my parents were out of town and I just threw this giant party at their house. I invited like 15 people over. 4 hours later, it was, full house, 150 people that I didn't know.
Right.
And it was probably like 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, and one of my friends, his older sister, put some cocaine on the table. And I remember telling myself, like in that moment, like if you try this, it is going to completely change the trajectory of your life. And I just didn't care because I so felt this need to be like included in what everyone else was doing.
Wow.
And I needed to belong. I didn't want to be the odd man out anymore. And, I just had this like voice inside me that said, you are going to mess up your life if this is the choice that you make. And, that need to feel that belonging just completely overrode that.
Yep.
And, what do you know? Like that voice was right. And, that led into about, 2.5 years, 3 years of narcotics use. And, I finally came to a point where, I had graduated, as we say in recovery rooms, we had graduated from, I graduated from cocaine to methamphetamine. And really my first step experience where,
How old were you when you first took that hit at that party?
I was 18 years old.
Okay, so you were drinking kind of like middle school alone, and then that was when you stepped into it.
Yeah, so I had started drinking, like I mentioned earlier, at age 12. Really when I stepped into therapy, and a lot of the issues from my childhood were starting to come to light, and I was like, therapy isn't working, and I found a solution in alcohol, and that's when I started smoking weed as well. But 18 was the age when I started using what we would consider to be like narcotic drugs, more regularly.
Yeah, so you're 18 now at this party and this happens.
Yeah,
Okay.
exactly. And I think a part of me at that point too was like, I'm an adult, I can do what I want. Like,
Yeah.
I almost had this kind of mission where, I wanted to prove my parents wrong. Like it was almost
Oh, that
like
you
a,
could do it in
yeah, like it was
moderation,
almost
yeah.
like a watch me, like I don't have to be like my parents, even though I was making the exact same choices that they had made and were continuing to make their entire lives.
Right.
But it was like, you know what? Like, I'm not them. I can successfully use these highly addictive chemicals
Yep.
and just be this like unique medical case where I'm the only one in human history that doesn't get addicted to it.
Yep. Yeah, I've tried that with porn, like in moderation, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's just we're not designed to. And I actually had this experience, like a week or two ago, when I spoke to a medical doctor who's also a health and wellness coach, about it, and I was kind of beating myself up for the fact that I don't really keep any sugar or candy in my house.
I wouldn't be able to do
because that. I can't. Yeah, like yeah, the yeah. minute I, seriously, it's like it's a kind of a cliche thing to say, but like if I have like a big box of Reese's Pieces, like I will eat the whole thing
in 5 minutes.
100%. Like it doesn't matter how big it is. And so I can't do it. And then I was like being hard on myself, and I was like, you know, your weakness or whatever. And then eventually I got to the point where I realized like it's not a natural food. Like it's this thing that we've manufactured and processed, and like any human on some level would struggle with like using it in moderate ways. And it's like, I don't think cocaine or meth was designed to be used socially in moderation.
No, absolutely not.
And obviously some people are more prone to getting addicted, but I don't think there's anyone who's like healthily using cocaine once in a while and it's good for them.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like the comparison, right? Where it's you know, using prescription medication as prescribed is okay, but the second you start taking it outside of the prescription, it's yep. abuse.
Yep.
You know, in the same lines, like, you know, drinking alcohol is a legal thing to do. It's okay. Like if you're over the age of 21 and you have a beer on a Friday night, like there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's then you take a substance that is like a Schedule 1 or a Schedule 2 narcotic.
Right.
It's regulated, it's enforced, it's against the law, like it's a felony to possess. You know, using that in any capacity, like even if you're only using it once a week
mm-hmm.
and you're only using like, you know, a quarter of a gram, like you've still got an issue because you are still, you know, you're breaking the law to do it.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, you take something even as simple as caffeine. I need a cup of coffee in the morning when I wake up,
mm-hmm.
or I will not have a good day. Like the first 4 hours of my day are going to be absolutely horrible. You know, and to just kind of look at that, like that's a dependency issue.
100%.
You know, if I don't have my morning caffeine, like I'm going to yell at a coworker.
Right.
And, you know, it's an addictive chemical, but it's just not regulated. So it's just more socially acceptable. And I don't think that it's recognized. And it's the same thing with sugar.
Yeah.
You know, are these like the processed, you know, chemicals like you have in like candy or even like the sugars, any sugar outside of like naturally produced organic fruit.
Fruit, yeah.
But I mean, I was the exact same way.
Yeah.
Like this last Halloween, we bought a bag of candy for trick-or-treaters.
Yeah.
And we had one family come to our door. And I don't think that bag of candy lasted more than a day.
Yeah. No, on Halloween, I was lucky because I didn't buy any candy to give out. The day kind of crept up on me. And then my neighbors was like, hey, here's a bunch of extra candy you can put out or give to kids. I was like, okay, thanks. And so some people came, but then I was left with this huge basket of candy. I'm like, oh God. Like, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to bring it to recovery. I'll put it in my car. It's usually what I do with stuff. Leave it in the trunk and then bring it to the next meeting I go to. And, but anyway, like someone took, like the whole thing was gone the next morning. I was like, someone stole my Halloween basket and all the candy. Good. Like, I'm not going to eat it. Turned out it was my neighbor. He's like, I didn't want to attract animals where I cleaned up all our, you know, like, oh, thanks. And then he just never gave it back. I was like, great. Cause I would just eat it all. But I like what you're saying, just kind of on the point of it's very tough because obviously in society, there are certain things that are not only legal, but encouraged and kind of look cool and so much advertising around it, like alcohol, like sex, like we're almost designed to like have sugar, sex and alcohol addictions mm-hmm. just by, if you just watch a bunch of TV and you watch shows and see all the commercials. So yeah,
it's like a societal influence, like
for sure.
It's not only encouraged, but it's almost as if these behaviors are expected of you, like as an adult human, right? Like even if you're just like a single male that's looking to go out and, you know, just date like casually, like to go out. I remember when I first gotten sober and I was kind of preparing myself to put myself back out there into, you know, the lovely world of dating and getting to know people. It was so weird for me to go out and try to have a social interaction with someone that, you know, was almost expecting us to like go out and grab a burger, grab drinks, have and have that conversation of like, no, I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Because if I do, I will ruin your life. you know, and that does kind of take me back to, you know, trying to segue this into when I realized that I actually had an issue. One of the things that I kind of realized when I started doing cocaine was, you know, especially after I turned 21 and it really ramped up. I had just come home from a deployment to Central America with my unit, and, you know, I had several things that happened back home, you know, with, you know, an ex relationship and, you know, just some things with, you know, everything that happens while you're gone. You know, I think that when service members deploy, we kind of just put lives at home kind of on pause. And what happens is we come back and we expect everything to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone else has just been living life. And, you know, when that hits you, especially if the ways they've been living their life don't live up to your expectations, it's really overwhelming. So when I'd gotten back from that deployment, that's when I really stepped into what I would consider to be like my true alcoholic life, my true, you know, experience with addiction. Up until this point, you know, I had been drinking like an alcoholic, but I wasn't, you know, getting blackout drunk every single night. I wasn't getting high every single day. But I remember for the 6 months following that deployment, I was blackout drunk almost every single night. You know, I would go through between 8 to 10 grams of cocaine every single day, and I blew through $35,000 in 6 months. And, you know, going out, I kind of just had this notion of like, you realize that like everyone does cocaine. Like where I was living at the time, the bars that I was going to, like it was very rare that someone would either notice you were doing it or, you know, realize that you had it and not either ask for it or just even like turn a blind eye.
And how old were you at this stage?
I was 21.
Got it.
Okay. 21 years old.
Yep.
And so for me, even like the amount that I was using at that time, like it was still in my eyes something that was socially acceptable.
Right.
You know, even though looking back on it now, it's not normal behavior. I think it's just the people that I surrounded myself with.
Yep.
You know, I surrounded myself with people that were going to validate what I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, because I had to do that because I wasn't about to put myself in relationships where I felt like I was doing the wrong thing. You know, I had just come out of a 2-year relationship where I felt like everything I did was wrong.
Yeah.
And I didn't want my friendships to look like that anymore.
Right.
Even though everything I was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
I surrounded myself with people that were doing all the wrong things that I was doing. And right. I'm like, I made it okay.
Yeah.
You know, so I think the very first warning sign was, you know, it was right after those 6 months, and I had a friend that had just graduated from a 90-day rehab. And, you know, at this point in time, like rehab to me was, you know, I didn't really comprehend what that was. You know, no one had ever talked to me about it. I had never gone. You know, I knew a couple friends in high school that had gone on these like, you know, 30-day vacations, like a behavioral program. But like, that was really my only experience with it. And, you know, he hit me up and he was like, hey, I just graduated this program. I've got some cocaine. Do you want to get high? I'm like, sure, dude. Like,
why is he? So he was just like, I'm done. I'm ready to start.
Yeah. Using. Yeah. He was just like, I think for him, it was like a mandated thing.
Okay.
You know, like his family made him go, or
okay.
I don't know if it was the courts or something, but there's a lot of, and this is actually really unfortunate that I think that there's a lot of people that aren't ready to get clean or
yeah.
aren't ready to get sober that will go to these programs and yeah. they come out with the exact same mindset
yeah.
that they had when they went in. And, you know, I think that for one, I don't think that 30 days is enough. I know it works for some people. But you have these medical rehabs that are out there that take, you know, 30 days, and you spend, or your insurance spends, you know, upwards of $40,000 to $50,000, and, you know, you come out the exact same person because internally you just aren't ready. You're not ready to give it up.
Yeah.
So he messaged me, and, you know, I went and I picked him up at a bus station, and, you know, I was like, sure, like, dude, like, come on over, like, we'll get high. And it was actually funny because about a week prior to this, I had said that I'd be done using.
What made you say that?
So I had actually just gone on a date with someone, and they were a very sweet woman. And I was like, you know what? Like, if I'm going to be with this person, I have to get clean. I can't be using, you know, I know it's not something that is, you know, really going to be beneficial in a relationship.
Right.
Like I still hadn't wrapped my mind around the idea that what I was doing was wrong. I just knew that it wouldn't help me in this particular situation.
Yeah. This is all before, because I definitely want to hear that famous Tinder story again. And that, this is before all that relationship, right?
So that actually is the infamous Tinder story.
Let's go.
So I had just gone on like a probably a week long bender, using from 5 in the evening until 5 in the morning, sleeping all day, waking up, rinse, repeat, right? And it was either like a Thursday or a Friday. I honestly, I don't know. It was years ago, but I was awake probably 3 or 4 in the morning, and I was just, swiping right, swiping right, swiping right, swiping left, swiping right, swiping right, swiping right, swiping left, and boom, like I get a match, which didn't happen all that often. So I was pretty excited, pretty stoked, and I took this woman out on a date. And
where were you guys living at the time?
I was living in Vancouver, Washington.
Okay.
Kind of just north of where I grew up in Portland, Oregon.
Okay. And then and what did you guys do for the date?
We went to it's a place in Oregon. They have several locations. It's called McMenamin's Pub and Brewery.
Okay.
Kind of like a low key burger place, grill food.
Sure.
We went, we had a connection, and I told myself, like, after that first, obviously I was high during the date. But I told myself after that, I was like, you know what? I cannot do drugs and be with this person.
Right.
Like this, it's just not a good idea. So like right then and there, I stopped, and it lasted about 7 days until my friend hit me up and said, hey, do you want to get high? And I was like, you know what? We'll do like one last little hurrah. Like, I'm not buying the drugs, so it doesn't count.
Yeah.
And like that was that. Like I picked him up in my car, and we're driving back to my apartment in Vancouver, Washington. And he just kind of casually mentions, like as one does, that he had brought crystal meth, so methamphetamine.
Had you done meth yet?
No, absolutely not. Okay. In my mind, cocaine was normalized at this point.
Sure.
Like it was a social drug that people used when they wanted to just kind of feel elevated, feel happy, feel hyper. And to me, the heavier narcotics, like methamphetamine, heroin, fentanyl, to me, those had always been the drugs that destroyed my parents' lives. Those were the drugs that were the reason that they couldn't be together, the reason that they couldn't raise me. They were the reason why I ended up with this abandonment issue. My parents didn't want me. They didn't love me. Why didn't they get clean for me? And I had always had a very, very, I think it was probably a correct fear, for these drugs. They were always the ones that I told myself, like, you're never going to do that. Like those are drugs that like the lowest of the low people use. Like it's a dirty thing to do those. So I got, I think justifiably kind of angry, because it was very upsetting. For one, I didn't
that you did stepped over that line.
Yeah. I think like after the fact, it was kind of embarrassing. It was kind of shameful. But I was also just upset with him, because I didn't realize that this person that I was associating with was like those people.
Do you remember into the moment when you had that choice point and like, if there was any thought process around like, okay, I'm going to do, was it the same? Like, I don't care. Was it the wanting attention? Like,
yeah, I think it was a mixture of the both. Predominantly though, it was just the urge to continue getting high.
Right.
At this point I had really regulated my thought process into, if you're desperate enough to just keep getting high, like you'll just do whatever it takes. Mm-hmm. And I think I had never truly understood like just how addictive methamphetamine really was. Mm-hmm. I had had my experiences with cocaine, and up until that point, like I did it on a daily basis and I had never tried to quit. And I didn't really understand just how powerful it is. And so in the moment, we get back to the apartment, and we run out of cocaine probably at like midnight, 12:30 in the morning, which was a very, very early night. And I'm coming down, he's coming down, and I'm like, like this isn't a comfortable feeling. I'm not going to touch it, but you can use the meth that you brought. so that you can keep getting high. Like, I'm not going to tell you what to do with your drugs. And, you know, he pulled out the pipe and, you know, he lit like a little Bic lighter and he, you know, took a hit. And in that moment, it truly dissipated all of my fear, because, you know, I had made it up in my mind to be this like heinous, disgusting act of just like self-destruction. And he made it look as easy as smoking a cigarette, which is something I had done probably 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my mind, I was like, that doesn't look that bad. And I really want to keep getting high. And I told him, I'll just try one hit. And I didn't put the pipe down for 6 months.
Famous last words.
Famous last word. You know,
I'll just try one hit.
You know, it's funny though, because out of all the things that have happened to me over the course of my life since I used cocaine for the first time, I can trace all of it back to that one moment.
Of using the meth.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Because everything that I did using cocaine, you know, led up to that moment. And then everything after that moment was just, I mean, it, you know, I would not be the person that I am today had I ever made that decision.
Yeah.
Like everything, I don't want to blame everything negative that's happened in my life since then on drugs.
Right.
Obviously I made my choices and I put myself in situations, you know, but using drugs definitely put me on a course to where, you know, I was in the position to have to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because I actually met several people while I was using cocaine, just within my social circle, that were actually the ones that, you know, once I tried that first hit of meth and I decided that it was something I wanted to keep using, that were actually able to help me make the connections to the people that I would, you know, continue to buy my drugs from for the next, you know,
yeah,
however many years.
Really a pattern here of who you're surrounding yourself with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how it's impacted your life. Yeah. Did you feel like when you used meth for the first time, like what did that feel like? Did it feel like the 100x version of cocaine? Did it just feel like a continuation? Like, did it feel even more like, I don't know what the word is, but like, so freeing, escaping, like, you know, whatever that feeling is, high?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm very lucky that I'm at a point in my life where I've distanced myself so far from my drug use that it's actually difficult for me to remember what it felt like. But I can remember that in that moment, I was just thinking, this is the best thing that I've ever done.
Wow.
Like that feeling that it brought me, where like I knew that this was the drug that I had always needed to do. Mm. Like I wasn't mad at myself. I wasn't upset with myself. The only thing that I was upset with in that moment is that I hadn't done meth earlier.
Wow. So the girl that you went on the date with, was that the one that you had that relationship with and then you saw her later Tinder profile that mentioned?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah.
So walk us through, because I want to do that story justice.
Yeah.
But walk us through like how you guys kept going and where your drug use kind of fit into all that.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, you know, my intentions going into that relationship were to, you know, change who I was. You know, I wanted to better myself as a person. It's not that I thought that I had an issue with drugs. I just knew that I didn't want to do them if I was dating her. And obviously, when I started using meth, that all changed. You know, on a chemical level, methamphetamine is, you know, far more addictive than cocaine. I think the dependency, you know, both chemically and then just like emotionally, like you have two sides to addiction, right? You have like the physical dependency, and then you also have like the emotional dependency, right? Where, you know, my ability to regulate my mood, my ability to regulate my emotions, you know, even down to like how I would treat other people, how I would feel about myself, all became dependent on this drug. You know, so like right off the bat, it's not that I tried to quit right away, because I definitely didn't, but it's almost like I knew deep down that like if I did, it wouldn't work.
Like your life would be unmanageable without the drug.
Yeah, exactly. Like yeah. For me, drugs had been a solution for so long that I actually talked myself into believing that I would be a better person for her
on the drugs.
On the drugs.
Yeah.
than I would be off of it. You know, and we continued that relationship for, you know, about 8 months.
Did she know, at what point in that 8 months did she know you were using?
I really can't pinpoint the exact moment. I genuinely think that I don't think it was ever a situation where like she found it or, you know, she found out about it. I think it was a moment where I probably just admitted it to her. You know, because I had a lot of behaviors that were very, very hard to explain. Like my inability to sleep, the fact that I was always out, I wouldn't come home for 3 days. You know, some of the people that I was hanging around with, you know, but I was, you know, so good back then, I think, at manipulating how people felt about me, because that's all I'd ever done. You know, my entire teenage year and, you know, young adult life was spent trying to control other people's perception of who I was. And, you know, I had gotten, you know, unfortunately very good at it. And, you know, she was a very innocent young woman. You know, she had never had experiences with drugs. She had never socialized with people that use drugs. And all I know is that by the time she found out that I was using, she had already had enough of a positive relationship with me that I think when I broke it to her, hey, I've been using this whole time, you know, she thought that that's how it would continue to be. And, you know, I just convinced her, like, it's just recreational, it's just for fun. You know, I might have thrown something in there about how it helps me manage my ADHD.
Yeah, I'm only doing meth.
Yeah, exactly.
My doctor prescribed it.
Yeah, that'd be nice. No, I didn't have to deal with prescriptions. I didn't deal with doctors. I dealt with people on shady street corners. But, you know, and I don't think in that moment that she felt all that negative about it. I'm sure there was some apprehension. But, you know, we were so deep in the relationship at that point that I truly don't think she knew what to do with that information. And I just kept using, you know, and for the last like probably 5 months of our relationship, I'd say that was like the time period where she knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she watched me go through, you know, severe changes with this drug. I think when we started dating, I was probably 165, 170 pounds. When I went to rehab for the first time towards the end of our relationship, you know, you step on a scale, like, you know, they do like a drug test, physical, because they're going into detox. You know, I weighed probably about 140 pounds. So I had lost about 35 pounds in weight. You know, she saw and walked through the development of, you know, some of the more extreme mental health issues, whether that was depression, anxiety, full-blown psychosis, you know, paranoia. So she saw me through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it just got to a point where by the time I was out of rehab, you know, she had this like 30-day window without me to really just gain clarity on, honestly, what a terrible person I was, you know, that she finally made the decision to end that relationship.
So how did you end up in rehab? Because that was something we didn't really get to before. It's like, you know, how did you kind of make that decision of like, okay, there's a problem, I want to get help?
Yeah, so that decision was actually made for me.
Okay.
It got to a point where, you know, I started having to do certain things to support my drug addiction. You know, and it got to a point where we were actually out at dinner one night at a restaurant in Sherwood, Oregon that her mother worked at. And I remember her getting a text from her mom. And I just remember like the entire atmosphere in that booth shifted immediately. And, you know, she kind of just leaned over and she told me like, hey, the man that her mom was dating at the time found your drugs in the garage. So like cats out of the bag, like they knew. And, you know, I immediately, like, we got up, rushed home, and, you know, they weren't there. I grabbed the drugs and, you know, in that moment, I was like afraid and I just disappeared. And I went out to, you know, a friend's property, just got high all night. And I remember rolling back onto their property at like probably 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, and they were just standing in the garage, kind of like intervention style. And, you know, I remember it like clear as day. I could paint a mental picture and like pretty much run through that entire conversation. Like it is ingrained into my memory.
When your girlfriend's mom found it, did your girlfriend know that you were using drugs like previous to that?
Yeah.
Okay. So it was really more kind of her mom like stepping in and highlighting this.
Well, yeah. And then the main difference was that, you know, obviously like our parents have a significantly larger amount of life experience.
Yeah, they have more wisdom typically.
Yeah, they're wiser, they've lived longer, they've had more experience, and you know, it's safe to say that, you know, someone twice my age isn't going to be as prone to my manipulation as someone that's younger than me. And I remember walking into that garage and, you know, they were screaming at me, yelling at me. They were upset, you know, rightfully so. Like they had just found out that their daughter had been dating a drug addict, that, you know, I was the one that had been stealing from them. And, you know, I regret all of those decisions.
For sure. Yeah.
But it was really in that moment that I had my first, you know, first step experience where I was like, oh my gosh, like I am a drug addict. You know, and it took, you know, three adults screaming it at me for me to really see it, because, you know, I always thought that my perception of who I was defined my identity, you know, but then you have someone that's outside that has like that outside perspective of who you are and how you're living your life that can bring clarity into, you know, how you see yourself.
Wow. And, wow. Yeah. That's just a visual I can almost see. So, yeah. Okay. So you're in that moment. How old were you at that time?
I would have been, I think I was still, my memory around this is actually so fuzzy.
Yeah.
I think I was still 21 years old.
Okay. And how old are you now?
Right now I'll be 26 on Tuesday.
And I love that because it just gives so much hope of how much recovery and freedom can happen in a short period of time.
It was a very, very quick turnaround. You know, my experience with narcotics was not very long. And I don't think that kind of devalidates my recovery. I think if anything, what it does is it just goes to show like just how quickly these drugs can, you know, take your life to ground zero.
Right.
You know, in that moment in that garage, you know, they offered me a choice, kind of trying to make a segue back to how I ended up back or in rehab for the first time. And, you know, it got to a point where, you know, I was defensive. I was like, no, I'm not an addict. Like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, really just trying to, you know, deny, like basically do anything I could to get myself out of this inescapable situation. And, you know, it got to a point where I literally on the floor of their garage, hit my knees, started sobbing. And I said like out loud, like, yes, I'm an addict for the first time in my entire life.
Wow.
And immediately after I said that, and you know, this is really to their credit, you know, I have absolutely no ill will towards these people. You know, out of all the people that I've met along my path of recovery, I would say that they have had, you know, probably one of the most profound impacts on who I am today and why I am, you know, the successful person that I am today was because of their courage and their boldness to like step out and, you know, really just lay into me, you know, and not coddle me or, you know, be gentle. Because there's a lot of people out there, I think, that, you know, really want to be gentle with people in their lives that they care about, that they see are struggling. And addiction is really one of those things where you can't, it works different for different people. But I think that the kind of the harsh approach really works best.
Oh yeah. I had a client one time. She actually reached out to me and was like, my daughter needs a coach. My daughter needs help. My daughter has an addiction. And I'm like, well, I think you and I should talk first.
Yeah.
Cause it was codependency and enabling the addict. And I was like, you're being, I mean, her daughter was a heroin addict.
Yeah.
And I was like, you need to just cut her off financially, emotionally, everything. You say, hey, I love you. I will give you everything if you go to rehab. But if you don't, we're no contact. Like,
yeah,
we can't. And she like didn't want to do it. And she was, the mom was scared. And I was like, just lay the boundary down. And she did. And then one day went by, crickets. 2 day went by. She called me. Oh, my daughter, she's going to die. She's never going to talk to me. She's going to call you.
Yeah.
Just wait and don't. And if she reaches out, but she's not willing to do rehab, don't respond. It's like, okay, third day, fourth day, fifth. Finally, daughter reached out. It's like, all right, I'll do rehab.
Yeah.
I need you in my life. I'll do it.
You have to allow the people in your life to kind of experience the consequences of their actions. Because, you know, without consequences, I don't think that I would have ever changed. You know, if I had never experienced the true consequences and like the true depravity and like hopelessness that I was living in, you know, I would have never had a reason to get clean in the first place. And I remember in that moment when I said those words, like, I am an addict, their entire attitude shifted. You know, they went from angry and furious and yelling and aggressive to, you know, the most caring and sweet people that I had ever seen them be. You know, and they're like, we're going to get you help. You know, we're going to do all these things. We're going to make sure that you're okay. And, you know, they just approached it in conversation and they're like, you know, were you the one that was stealing from us this entire time? And I said, like, yes, you know, I have been. So I was so broken at this point where I was just like, they know the worst thing about me. Like, I might as well just tell them everything.
Yep.
And, you know, they gave me an option. They said, you can either go to jail or you can go to rehab. And, you know, obviously I don't want to go to jail, so I chose to go to rehab. And I mean, even in that moment, it wasn't a choice. Like, if I had had another option, I would have taken it. You know, and so even though I'd had that first step experience, I think deep down, I truly wasn't ready to give up that life, which is why that first rehabs didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, I did 30 days in rehab, went to another program that was a little bit more, not relaxed, but it gave you a little bit more freedom. You know, you want to slowly reintroduce independence, you know, and responsibility into someone's life. And, you know, so I think it was like 60 days in total. And, you know, to get back to the Tinder story, you know, I probably made it like another 20 days sober after that. So I think I'd strung together just shy of 90 days of clean time.
By going to rehab and this.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, albeit like 60 days of those 90 days were spent in a monitored situation. So I can only really take credit.
Right.
I can only take credit for like 20 of those days.
Sure.
Yeah. But that's 20 days. Right. I mean, that's.
And it's out of your system for 3 months. And where did you guys leave it in terms of the relationship? Was that an implied breakup by that?
Yeah. So, I mean, and to her, I mean, she was an amazing woman. I'm sure she still is, you know, wherever she is. But she actually did something that was very, very helpful for me, where she said that I will stay with you all the way through rehab. Wow. You know, because I think in that moment, like if I was 10 days into that rehab and she told me that she was going to leave me, I would have left that rehab and tried to like chase her down.
Wow.
So I think it was actually her making that promise that gave me the ability to stick it out. And then the day that I graduated that second program and I was going to move into a sober living, we had dinner that night and she broke up with me. So like she was true to her word, but exactly true to her word.
Yeah.
Which is good because, you know, I brought a lot of dysfunction to this person's life.
Sure. And you were still on a recovery path and
exactly.
You know, you weren't ready for a relationship.
Yeah. I was in no way stable. I was in no way, you know, ready to be back on my feet. I was in no position to, you know, even be dating in the first place, let alone trying to heal a relationship where I had caused, you know, so much damage and mistrust. So it was probably like 2 weeks after that, I was out at a bonfire, just with some friends. And I remember, you know, I was single and I was bored and, you know, I wasn't drinking successfully. There was alcohol there, but I wasn't drinking it. I had like a guy there that I knew from high school that was kind of trying to hold me accountable, where I was like, I brought him and I was like, hey dude, just don't let me drink. You know, I thought that would work. You know, like he's going to stop me, like a 6'5" individual, from picking up and drinking a beer. But that was my plan. It was the best plan that I could come up with because again, I craved social interaction.
Right.
You know, and the best that I could do was a situation where there was alcohol. And that, I mean, that's very unfortunate that I didn't have the resources that I did when I came to California. That was the best that I could do. And, you know, I remember I kind of got bored at that event because I didn't really know that many people there. It was kind of like, you know, a friend of a friend's thing. And I just kind of showed up because, you know, I knew this guy's second cousin that his girlfriend was like, it was like very random connection. And I only knew like one person there. So I kind of just got bored and I was standing off in a corner and I was just swiping on Tinder. And I actually came across her profile again. And I remember just reading through it and the very, very bottom line of it, I can remember it to this day, said like verbatim, just out of a relationship with a drug addict and a thief who is 100% codependent on me, comma, so you won't have to try that hard. And I remember in that moment just being so angry and like resentful towards this person. Like I went over to the table and I picked up a beer and I chugged it.
Wow. Yeah. That's an understandable response to that emotional. Yeah.
I think a part of it for me too was that I wasn't yet confident in my ability as a sober individual. You know, I was still basing my identity on what other people thought of me.
Mm-hmm.
And very much in that moment, I was like, well, you know what? Because like through those 60 days, you know, I can genuinely say that I really only got clean for her. Like that was 100% of the reason that I got sober was I was like, I got to fix this relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think a part of me still truly cared what she thought about me. You know, and I was like upset and I was like, you know what? If you still think that I'm a drug addict, like I'm going to act like I'll show you, you know, I was like, if that's all anyone's going to think about me, even though I've got 70 days clean, 80 days clean, I might as well just drink anyways.
Right.
You know, so really just kind of introducing some of that codependency, you know, that mindset of, you know, I have to be perceived in a certain way or seen in a certain way by somebody else to be okay. Like I'm going to base my ability to be happy on someone else's actions.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, these are some of the defining moments though, where, I mean, you tell your story and it just gives hope to other people because in a span of, it sounds like 3-ish years,
mm-hmm.
you went from that to, I mean, I've met your wife, I've seen what you guys have. So how did that happen?
Yeah. So, you know, after that experience where, you know, that was my first experience with relapse. And unfortunately, it wasn't my last. You know, it probably took me 5 days after having that first drink to start using meth again. Probably like took another month for me to end up back in, you know, the same program that I had just been in. And, you know, over the course of, you know, almost the next year, I went to 4 more treatments. So I went to the first rehab again. So I went there a total of 3 times, twice inpatient, 1 outpatient. I tried a program in like just south of Oregon. I stayed there for about 2 weeks. I was like, I don't like this place. I'm out. And then, you know, finally that summer, I went back to the program that I went to the first time. And, you know, all throughout this, you know, kind of the common theme is that, you know, I still wasn't letting other people into my life. I still wasn't surrounding myself with, you know, productive people that were actually getting clean, doing the deal, and cared, you know, about their recovery lifestyle. I would just get out of rehab, keep talking to the same people, keep doing the same things, because that's where I was comfortable.
Right.
You know, and I made the mistake, you know, tens of times where I was like, you know what, I can keep hanging out with the friend that I always relapse with. And, you know, it finally got to a point where it was summer of 2020 and I had just gotten out of another 30-day stint in rehab. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do the deal. I'm going to do this thing. Like that was the first rehab that I went to where it was like my decision to go.
What? Yeah. And that was my next question. It's like, what kept you on this path of, well, you know, initially I'm just going to keep going, but then eventually like, I'm going to do this. Like, why weren't you the guy like from your story where he was like, oh, you know, this is court mandated, but like the minute it's over, I'm out. Like what kept you involved enough to start to get to that point to, okay, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, I think that, throughout those, I kind of call them like my middle rehab stints. Like there was the first one that didn't work, obviously, and then there was like that final one that stuck. I had all these like little vacations to rehab. And, the majority of those, like I would just get to a point where I knew I needed to get my family or my friends off my back. I needed to do something. I don't like I wasn't ready to get clean. I don't think that I truly like understood what it was going to take to get clean, but I knew that if I just went to a 30-day program, how they perceived me would like start to shift. And then I'd get them to a point where like they were confident in me again, and then I just like let them down. And then I'd start using again, and I'd get to a point where I'd hit another bottom and I'd be like, I need to go to rehab. Kind of like rinse and repeat, where each time I went and each time I relapsed, it was just like a quicker and quicker fall to kind of my what I would consider my rock bottoms. And once I would hit that bottom, I'd be like, you know what? Okay, pick myself up. I guess I'll go to rehab again, and then we just do it again. And that last time that I went to that 30-day program, before the treatment that actually stuck when I moved to California, it was shortly after my grandfather passed away. And this is actually one of my biggest regrets in life, was the story surrounding that situation. I was kind of couch surfing slash homeless at the time, and I was using with that same friend that I kept relapsing with.
This guy, man, he's got to
Ironically,
go.
I was like, he brings so much validation into my life. I'm just gonna be homeless and live with him. Like it's cool, right?
Yeah.
And the situation was that my grandfather had just had a surgery, and him and my grandmother were they're getting up there in age, but for the most part they were still healthy. Like they had all the things that come with old age. Like my grandmother had early onset dementia, Alzheimer's, but my grandfather for the most part was a fairly healthy older gentleman. And he had just had this surgery, and my parents, we had a very minimal contact at this point, but like if they were doing a dinner or doing a family event, like they would reach out, and try to connect with me. I think they kind of knew where I was. They just didn't want to believe it. And I'm using at this guy's apartment, and my dad sends me a text saying, hey, like, do you want to come over for dinner? And then we're going to go see your grandfather, because he was in a rehabilitative facility in Oregon, and for medical purposes, not for drug addiction, obviously. But after his surgery, he was just healing up. And I was like, yeah, sure. So I got in the car, and I'm driving. It's about probably 25, 30 minutes to my parents' house. And I get about halfway there, and I realized that I had left my methamphetamine and my pipe back at this dude's apartment. And, a part of me was like, I can't, exist if I'm not using drugs every 5 minutes. I have to go back and get it. And then another part of me was like, if I leave it there, they're gonna do my drugs. So I text my dad, and I'm like, hey, dad, I left my wallet back at my buddy's place. I have to go back and get it. So, it takes me about 15 minutes to get back to his house, the 30 minutes to get to my parents' place, and I'm on my way there, and I get out of the car, and my dad basically comes running out of the house. He says, we have to get in the car right now. Your grandfather is dying. So it was like a very sudden turnaround. Like he went from recovering to he's passing away. And it was about 25 minutes out to where he was being taken care of at the time. And I remember we get there, and it was during COVID. So you had to like visit them from like outside the building. They had windows. They were only allowing like two people in the room at a time,
Yeah,
immediate family
especially
only.
elderly people,
Yeah,
during
exactly.
COVID,
And rightfully so. Like we want to keep, our elderly people healthy and, safe and secure and all that. But it was just sad, because I remember walking up to this window with my parents and my younger brother, and I remember just looking at him, and like in my mind, I'm thinking, wow, like he looks like he's sleeping. And my dad's sister was in the room with him at the time, and she comes outside and she's crying. And she tells my parents that he had passed away 5 minutes before we got there. And it was that experience where I kind of had this feeling like, oh my gosh, like the fact that I couldn't go an hour and a half without using is the reason that my father could not say goodbye to his dad, like in his final hours of life. And, you know, fast forward about 5-6 days, we're having the funeral and all of our family's in town. And obviously, like, I'm still using, still out on the streets. I think at the time I was like literally living in like some stranger's like tweaked out RV, like off the side of a road somewhere. And, you know, my parents, we had like a little reception at our house. Sorry, it's like I still get emotional thinking about this because it's like to this day one of my biggest regrets. And I come over to the house. I'm obviously high, and like the whole family's there, and there's some family members that have struggled with substance use, you know, my dad's side of the family, and they've all recovered. They're all doing great. They all have amazing families, but they know things about people that use. Like, they can recognize the signs. They can tell when you're high. Like, obviously, like, I'm covered in sores at this point. Like, I've been picking at my face. I've been picking at my arms. And, you know, it's explainable to random people, but for people that have experience with drug addiction, it's very, very obvious. And, you know, one family member kind of pulls me aside in the backyard. We're just smoking a cigarette, and she just, like, plain out says, like, hey, when's the last time you used? And I remember telling her, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, I've been clean since I got out of rehab. And she's like, no, I'm being serious. You need to tell me when the last time you used was. And I was like still denying it. She asked me again. And I was like, okay. Like, you know, I used a week ago, trying to kind of downplay the seriousness of the situation. And she just repeated the question, you know, one more time. She's like, no, like, you need to tell me right now. Like, when was the last time you used? And I broke down, and I was like 15 minutes ago. And, you know, in that moment, you know, that combined with the regret of what had just happened was the first time that I approached my family honestly before they knew or before they brought it up. And I said, I relapsed. I need to drive myself and check into rehab. And, you know, that program wasn't the program that got me sober, you know, to the point that I am today. But that was the first program that I went into with an attitude of like, I need to make this choice. Like,
yeah, was your decision.
Yeah, like, it was
commitment. Yeah.
Like, I am doing this because I do not like the person that I am when I'm using.
Right.
So I got out of that program, you know, really like invigorated. Like, I actually was very enthusiastic about my recovery. And, you know, I did very well. So I, you know, quote unquote, graduated that program, I think like early July. And I remember it was
of 2020.
Yeah, 2020. And it was the day before my brother's birthday. So I don't know how many days are in July. 30, 31.
let me Google it.
I'm almost 26 years old, and I still don't know this, but it was
31.
31. Okay. Yeah. So I know the date because it was before my brother's birthday. And so it was July 31st of 2020, and I'm living in the sober living. I'm actually doing really good. Like, I have a job, I have employment. Like, I was in, you know, a semi-healthy relationship with someone else in the recovery community. And that same friend, yeah, this guy, right? He just messages me and he's like, hey, dude, like, do you want to hang out? And I was like, let me think. Like, I literally texted him, like, let me think about it. Like, I knew deep down, like, this is something that, like, I have to think about. And I remember I messaged the girl I was dating at the time because she was in recovery. She had a couple years clean. And I was like, hey, this guy wants to hang out with me. What do you think? And she knew who he was, like, in my life and our history.
Right.
And she was like, this is not a good idea. And once again, like, I had that ego. I had that chip on my shoulder where I'm like, you know, I'm going to prove you right. Right. Because I was like, in this situation, I feel like I'm making a wrong decision, but I have to prove to you that I actually know what I'm doing. And so I told him, hey, dude, like, you can come over to my sober living and we can hang out there.
Okay.
Thinking in my mind, like, hey, this will be safe. Right.
Yeah.
And it's probably like 5-6 o'clock in the evening. And he comes over, we're just hanging out, kind of just catching up. And I actually think he might have been clean for a little bit that time, like maybe, you know, a couple weeks, like not a serious amount. But I just remember that factored into the decision. I just kind of forgotten how quickly that thing could turn around.
Yep.
And I remember it was like probably 15 to 20 minutes after he got there. He shot me a text saying, like, hey, do you want to try to pick up?
Wait, after, but you guys weren't together?
No, so he had come over to the apartment and we were
Right.
just hanging out, catching up. And probably 15 minutes into our conversation,
Oh, he's.
Yeah, he just messaged me. He's like, hey, like, it was funny because he didn't even ask it out loud. He just texted me.
Yeah. I'm like, aren't you guys together?
Yeah, exactly. But I was like, why do you?
I guess
Why?
Because of your apps.
Yeah,
Like,
we're
okay.
in a so, like,
Yeah.
that'd be an interesting conversation over here, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, dude, like, let's get high. And I just remember again in that moment, like the lack of self-control, I was very confident. I was like, you know what? But we're only gonna get high until 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah. Only till six.
Only till six.
Yeah.
And obviously that led into, you know, another disastrous relapse, like another downslide into mental health issues, suicidal behavior. Like that was probably one of the worst relapses. And that finally came to kind of a screeching halt in November of 2020. It was 3 days before my clean date. You know, we were just kind of bouncing around from motel to motel, and I was just doing drugs in a motel room, and I accidentally smoked fentanyl, and I overdosed and I died in that hotel room. You know, luckily for me, they come around at like 11 o'clock in the morning to do bed checks, like room checks, to make sure no one's doing double occupancy or like overstaying or doing, you know, drugs, funnily enough. And what ended up happening was the hotel clerk came into my room at precisely the right time, administered 3 shots of Narcan, and brought me back to life.
Wait, who did this?
It was the person that works at the hotel.
And did they know how to use these things?
Oh, 100%. It was, I mean, it's a Motel 6.
It's a motel for people, drug
it's
users.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, I don't want to get sued, so if anyone
yeah.
working at Motel 6 hears this, don't sue me. But it's just known for being kind of seedy.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. So like right at the aligned time, how long were you actually, you know, like, do you know how long you were dead for?
I honestly have no idea. I don't have like a memory
but
of
the
it.
Timing just worked out that,
yeah,
if...
the timing was just insanely perfect. I mean, there's probably, you know, 200 rooms at this motel, and like there's a window of opportunity where you can bring someone back. Like,
yeah.
Obviously, if you're dead for so long, like,
yeah, it's
you're
probably a few minutes,
like,
right?
otherwise no one would ever die, right? But
a few minutes.
But it was probably like the first, you know, miracle from God.
Yeah.
That I was like, that I truly recognized, I think. And what's ironic is that in that moment, like, that's not what got me clean. I kept using.
After that,
after that happened.
Yeah, but only for a few more days, right?
Yeah, only for a few more days. But it was that moment where I was like, oh crap, you know, and I told my parents, like, hey, I think I need help. Again, you know, I wanted to make that decision to get clean. I just didn't have the physical ability to stop using.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my dad, being the amazing dad that he is, was searching for Christian recovery programs.
Yeah.
My parents are both Catholic. They're Roman Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I stepped away from my faith probably when I was, you know, 11, 12 years old. Really turned my back on my faith, turned my back on God. I never stopped believing in him. I just stopped believing that he cared about me. And what happened was that, you know, I had had so many experiences with trying to get clean, doing everything I could imagine a person could do. And, you know, what made this decision, I really think the one that worked, was that I had finally gotten to the end of myself. Like,
yeah, you've tried everything.
I've tried everything I can possibly do in my own power,
and you can't,
to make myself stay clean.
Yep.
And unfortunately, like, that's just not how this works. You know, if it was only up to us, like, people would never have a problem getting clean in the first place. Like, we would just make a decision and then boom, like, you're healed.
Yeah.
The problem is that it's a very, very, very real disease that needs, you know, physical healing and like mental cleansing.
Yeah, spiritual and
yeah,
mental
exactly.
Cleansing. Yeah. Why did your dad, I mean, was he looking for like a Catholic program? Like, what made him go for the Christian? Did he know on some level like bringing God in would help?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, any seasoned person of faith understands that, you know, God can really bring us out of anything.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, my parents weren't oblivious to my journey. you know, they saw me trying and trying and trying over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, my dad, he's just the man of faith that he is. I mean, his faith is like insurmountable. Like I have never met a man more faithful and like devoted to God than my father. And I think he just got to a point where he realized that if there is something that's going to save my son, it's going to be Jesus Christ.
That makes sense. So what was it about, I guess, was the next step awake in recovery? Or what eventually was the thing that made, okay, this is my sober date?
Yeah, so my sober date is November 18th of 2020.
Right.
And that is the day that my parents put me on a plane with a one-way ticket to San Diego, California. Destination Restoration Ranch in Ramona, shameless plug. That place absolutely saved my life. You know, I went there and I really threw, you know, all my preconceived notions of what recovery should look like or how I should do it out the window. You know, this was really my true rock bottom. I mean, I had just been dead on the floor of a $70 a night hotel. You know, like it was bad. And I said, everything that I haven't changed yet, I'm going to change now. So, you know, like up until this point, I'd only ever done 30-day programs. This was a 6-month program. I promised myself I would stay for a year. You know, I said, like, I'm committed. You know, I flew to a separate state, moved away from my family, completely left the situation that I was living in at the time. You know, all those people that I thought were my friends that I'd surrounded myself with that made me feel so comfortable, I left all of that behind.
What did you do with the guy that always, like, you know, he's the 10th? What happened with him?
He got blocked on Facebook.
Okay, so you just blocked
him. Yeah, I just blocked him.
Yeah.
I
mean, that was long overdue.
Yeah, very, very long overdue.
Yeah.
But it was just something that I had just never done. Right. It was just one of those steps that needed to take place that it was one of those things in my life that I just wasn't willing to give up.
Yeah.
You know, because it provided me with an excuse to keep using.
100%.
Because, you know, if I realize, I could just blame him.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't my decision. You know,
absolutely,
he talked me into it,
mm-hmm.
right? It's kind of like the original story, like original sin, like the fall of man, where, you know, Adam is blaming Eve for his decision. He says, you know, like, look, like the woman made me do it, where it's refusing to take accountability for your actions, you know, and just kind of hoping that it alleviates some of the pressure on your own life. So I think he was just a very, very convenient scapegoat. You know, I mean, everyone knew that it was me, like I was the one making these choices, but I feel like it made me kind of almost feel better about myself, where I kept telling myself, like, oh, if he hadn't been there, I wouldn't have made that decision. Even though, like, once I know I want to get high, like, I will do whatever it takes.
Yeah.
So I came down to Restoration Ranch that day, checked myself in, and, you know, it was there that, you know, for the first time, I started to experience God again. You know, I've shared this a few times at Awake in Recovery when I speak, but, you know, all I knew at that time was that God was real. I didn't know if he loved me. I didn't know if I loved him. I just knew that trusting him was the only thing that I hadn't tried yet. And I was desperate enough to overlook my negative views of my previous faith to give it another shot.
Yeah.
You know, and it was in that desperation that God met me and said, hey, let me start transforming your life slowly. Like, not on your timetable, not on your idea of how things should go, but, you know, just surrender your life to me and just let me work in you. And I think it was probably took a couple months, you know, for me to, you know, kind of stand up, say that prayer, you know, give my life to Christ. 4 months in, I got baptized, and, you know, the rest was kind of history. I put myself in a position to succeed. You know, the program was such a long time that, you know, because I stayed for a year, you know, you experience almost everything that you're going to experience in 12 months. You know, yeah. You're going to experience some things that are negative. You're going to experience, you know, a bad boss, you're going to experience hardship, you're going to experience, you know, broken relationships. And I had a chance to experience all of the things that I would have normally relapsed over in the past within kind of a safe bubble of support and recovery.
So you learned how to make better choices when things came up.
Yeah, exactly. I was in a place where, you know, I would come home after a bad day and I would have people that would pray for me and disciple me and guide me. And, you know, I think it was about 6 months in that I just hit my knees one day and I was really struggling with the obsession, right? There, like, we have the physical addiction that, quite frankly, like, once you're through your detox period, you're no longer physically addicted to drugs. So you'll have people in recovery that'll say, they'll be 3 months in, they'll be like, yeah, I'm really struggling with cravings right now. Cravings are just really bad. And like, it's not actually a craving. It's an obsession. You're obsessing over using drugs. You're telling yourself, in this situation, I think I can revert back to my old ways and it's going to work. And I was still struggling with that obsession. I would still have dreams where I would be using, I would wake up, I would feel high. I would hear people talking about kind of their old tales of using drugs. And I would literally start salivating. Like, I would have that euphoric recall. And, you know, I just hit my knees one morning. It was probably 4:30 in the morning. And I was like, you know, God, I can't do this anymore. I cannot have this weight on my shoulders anymore. Like, I'm clean, I'm sober, but I'm still struggling. And I know this isn't how it's supposed to be. I need a miracle. And in that moment, the obsession was lifted.
Supernatural.
Yeah. And it was another 6 months. I was probably just past a year clean that, you know, I started realizing that even though I'd given my life to Christ and even though I'd been living clean, that my life still had a serious amount of dysfunction in it. You know, I was still struggling with kind of some of those codependency issues. I was still struggling with not necessarily making friends, but just with connecting with people on like an emotional level where our relationship wasn't dependent on, you know, how they thought about me or how I thought about them. You know, I was still suffering from, you know, some depression, some anxiety. I was still having sex outside of marriage, watching porn. You know, I'd been through a couple of, you know, really not toxic relationships, but just unhealthy relationships because I was, you know, I wasn't acting the way that a godly Christian man was supposed to act.
But and that's like kind of normal though, like sort of phase two of addiction recovery. Because once you stop doing meth and coke, you're like, what are you left with? All the pain and emotions.
Yeah, exactly.
And so then you have kind of like the lower grade stuff, like Mark Gagarin, who came on the show, you know, he talked about kind of like his first, obviously, primary addiction, drugs and alcohol. And then phase two was California burritos and porn.
Yeah. Well, you have what are called cross addictions.
Exactly.
Right. So for me, I'm what like a medical rehab or like a substance abuse like doctor would call a dual diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So I had substance use disorder. And then on top of that, I had like my mental health diagnosis.
Right.
And what I've learned is that addiction and drug use isn't actually the problem. It's just a symptom.
Yep.
Right. So my real problems were all of the issues that predated addiction.
Yep.
Right. So addiction was actually what happened because of the underlying problems. And using drugs and drinking was just kind of my way of, you know, handling it or, you know, trying to heal from it. Like, I was trying to use alcohol and drugs to get rid of this bigger issue. And the problem is that we get clean and we expect that that's going to automatically take all of our problems away.
No, it actually just removes like the drug that's covering it.
Yeah.
Like, you, it's almost harder at without it.
Yeah. Well, because I had been using for so long that I had almost forgotten that, you know, I was stealing before I used drugs. I was lying before I used drugs. You know, I was manipulating long before drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, I started watching porn long before I ever picked up cocaine or started using meth. You know, the feelings of lust you know, existed way before I'd ever gotten high. And the problem was that since I'd been using for so long, you know, I kind of flipped that association. You know, I started to believe that all of those issues in my life existed because I was using drugs. And so, you know, when I'm at 6 months to a year clean and all those problems are still here, I just ask myself like one question, and that's like, what am I not doing? And that's where Awaken Recovery came in. You know, because I was doing the deal and, you know, I was living, you know, kind of the best life that I lived up to that point. But I kept telling myself, like, there's something missing.
Yeah.
You know, there is something that is missing from your life that is a result of you not addressing, you know, these traumas from your past.
So do you feel like kind of your rehab experience that last 1 year really helped lift the drug addiction, and then Awaken Recovery was like the underlying anxiety and the cross addictions? Mm-hmm. That was what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. It's impossible for us to move on from those underlying issues until we're clean.
Yeah.
Right. So like, cause I don't have the mental capacity to be high and then also like walk through depression or make clear choices, you know? So the drug addiction was life-threatening, physically harmful, you know, and clearly kind of the biggest issue on the table at the time, you know? So once, it's kind of like playing whack-a-mole. Like you get rid of that first one and then something else pops up and you take care of that. And like, you don't want to put too much on your plate. You know, there was no way that I had the strength to deal with everything all at once.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the beautiful thing about Awaken Recovery through the workshops is that, you know, you have a chance to deal with one issue.
Yep.
And then deal with another issue. And you can do it as many times as you want.
Yeah, and like each one every 6 months kind of thing, like tackle one at a time. Yeah. Cause I'm like that perfectionist. I'm like, oh, I see this guy and he's got, you know, he's married, his kids, big house. But I'm like, okay, I need it all right now.
Yeah.
Which
absolutely.
In itself
yeah.
is like an addictive
yeah.
addiction.
Yeah, because I mean, what you're telling yourself is that, like, I need these things in order to be okay.
Okay. Yeah.
And what I had to come to believe was that because my identity is in Jesus Christ, I am okay. Yeah. Even though I don't have all the stuff, I don't have all the things, you know, I had to teach myself that you can be okay and not have sex with strangers. You know,
yeah.
you can be okay and not have a nice car.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need 300 friends to be okay.
Best thing that ever happened to me was I bought this car that I have now. And I think I mainly bought it for kind of like me and for good reasons. But there was a part of me that it's like a Tesla Model S. It's the highest one. It's the get the new year, get the matte wrap on it, get the custom license.
Yeah. You drive it down the road, everyone goes, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, because again, from that place of lack or identity. And the weirdest thing happened, it was just such a, you know, it was so ordained where like, I almost felt like it was invisible to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Like no matter what, nobody could see this car. And I would like drive it around and park it right in front. And like, I didn't get one compliment on this car for like 2 years.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah. And, but that was because I needed to have the experience of like, look, your identity doesn't come from these things. And if you try to make it work, I'm just going to make it go in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, when I stepped into Awaken Recovery, you know, like I said, like my experience up until this point with the 12-step process had always been centered around substance use and alcoholism. So when I came to Awaken Recovery, that was the first time that, you know, I had really ever heard someone stand up in a room, you know, full of 50 people and say, you know, hi, my name is Brendan, and I'm recovered from porn addiction.
Right.
You know, to the point where, like, to me, almost that first night, like, I almost laughed a little bit because I was like, wait, what? You know, like, what do you mean? Like, what are you talking about porn addiction?
Yeah.
Like, I thought this was 12 steps. I thought this was recovery.
Yeah.
Like, kind of this, like, I've been through, like, the crappiest, you know, worst things that a person can endure. Like, how is this person going to stand up and say they struggle with codependency? You know, and then the more I started attending and the more I started just listening and kind of opening my heart to learning from people that were different than me, you know, the more I started to see, you know, some of those areas of my life where I'm like, oh my gosh, like, you know, if God can remove the obsession to use drugs, he can heal those areas also. And, you know, that's when I started really leaning into the church community. You know, for the first time, like, I was in a church where, you know, we talk openly about these behaviors. You know, I had spoken with several men at the church, and I surrounded myself with people immediately where they're like, yo, dude, like, you know, we don't watch porn. You know, we don't have sex outside of marriage. Like, all these things that were, like, still very new to me. And it was almost like a breath of fresh air, I think, because, you know, at this time in my life, like, I had gotten to the point where I was very, very good at comprehending that a certain behavior wasn't healthy. It just, I didn't have the power in my own life to stop doing it, just like drugs.
Yeah. And it's, and that's why, and a lot of people don't realize this, but porn can be an addiction, and social media can be an addiction, and shopping on Amazon can be an addiction, and watching, you know, I used to live in New York City, and an average Sunday for me was watch the 1 o'clock games. Basically, like, you know, get drunk the night before, sleep in till like noon, wake up, brunch, 1 o'clock football games, 1 to 4, 4 o'clock games, 4 to 7, go out for dinner, get even more drunk, Sunday night football till 11 p.m. And it's just like, and that's the thing about, obviously, the program we've been through, is you're working the same process that you would use to remove a drug addiction or these other things in life. And that was like ironic kind of in some ways around my addiction was, I, you know, when, like, you talk about surrounding yourself with the right people, like Mark Gagarin stood in, he was in this studio for the first time he ever came to my house. I looked at him and I'm like, you don't drink at all. Like, you don't drink socially, blah, blah. And cause I had like started to feel convicted about quitting alcohol. I was like, so into health and wellness and really into surfing. And I was like, you know, it wouldn't hurt to save some money and like shed a couple pounds, whatever. And then I'm surrounded by these people who don't drink and I'm like, cool. And so, but I kept drinking until New Year's Eve, 2 years ago, almost. It'll be 2 years for me sober from alcohol, you know, in like 7 days.
Nice.
And I'm out at this dinner, or I go to this pregame and I'm like bombing champagne flutes. And then we have wine and all stuff. And, you know, I just make this horrible comment to this woman at our, in our table party. And I had to make like 3 amends the next day.
Yep.
And I was like, all right, am I an alcoholic? I don't think so, but I'm done drinking. And for me, you know, and I've talked about this, I think the last episode I did was actually on how I, you know, not how, but like why I quit drinking and everything. And I was like, I just stopped. You know, and like that wasn't the case with pornography. That wasn't the case with like money spending, work addiction, travel, like the other things that I've really been like, I can't release those grips on my own strength. So, yeah.
Well, it's like in the Bible where it says it's not everything, or it says everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial, right? Like I know several people, more than several, you know, in my life today that are not alcoholics,
yeah,
that have given up alcohol because they're like, you know, even though I don't have a drinking problem, I can recognize that drinking is causing problems in my life. You know, you can have a dysfunctional behavior and not be addicted to that behavior.
100%.
Like, there are times when I will be talking with my wife and, you know, I will say something that, you know, isn't necessarily unkind, but like probably could have been said better. And it's not like I'm not addicted to being rude to my wife, but that's still a behavior that needs to be addressed.
100%.
Right. Yeah. Like that's still something I need to take to God and say, hey, look, this is the defect of character that I need you to remove.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to argue over which Mexican restaurant we're going to buy food from. Like, I'll just let her make that decision, just surrender it to God. Like, hey, you know, wipe my hands of it. And, you know, for me, that's the point that I was at when I was looking at these behaviors where I was like, you know what? I have a goal. You know, I have a vision for my future. And that's never going to come to pass if I'm engaged in these behaviors. And I remember it was like shortly before my first Emerge experience. I think it was 2021 was my, no.
I don't remember the branding of it. Who? Yeah, a couple of years ago. Yeah,
a couple of years ago. It was the it was the Emerge that took place right before I met my. How do I not remember the year I met? You can edit this out. I'm gonna try to remember.
No, we're leaving this in for
yeah.
the listener.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
No, we'll.
Because we already had Emerge 23.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So.
Yeah, it was probably Yeah, it was probably not this one, but 2022. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was shortly before Emerge 2022 where, you know, I was finally starting to realize what I wanted in life. You know, and I was in a church community with a lot of young adults and, you know, people that had very, very healthy relationships, had amazing marriages that were flourishing, they had children. And I was like, you know what, that's what I want. You know, I want a life partner. I want a family. I want to, you know, be a provider, be a protector, like everything that God called me to be. And I remember having a conversation with someone from Awake and Recovery, you know, surrounding like pornography and like sex outside of marriage. He's like, dude, like if you want a wife, you have to start preparing yourself now.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, I took to that men's conference was, you know, my issues with sex addiction, with lust and with pornography addiction. And, you know, really just the expectation that God was going to start preparing me, you know, for my future family. Because, you know, I had never had like a truly healthy relationship. You know, I had had relationships with people that were healthy where I was a dysfunctional one.
Right.
And I've had relationships where we were both dysfunctional. But, you know, I can honestly say that up until when I met my wife, I had never been the functional partner in a relationship.
Yeah. And you're like the fifth or sixth guy that I've met that has given me that hope, because before I kind of came into this community and saw like what this real supernatural healing is like, the best I ever saw was like, I mean, one guy maybe who was able to get married, but much later in life, wasn't able to have children, wasn't able to kind of like get it dialed in. Within the span of probably like the first few years or first 5-10 years. And I've just met so many people, like, you know, my friend Ryan, we were talking about earlier, like very similar story. Just had, like, I went up to him. I was like, yeah, but you don't know my background. You don't know how bad I'm. I've never had, he goes, yeah, I never had a help. Like I've met people who have never even been in any relationship, or they've been in a bunch and they're all codependent, all jacked up. Or like you said, you're the jacked up one. And then they just like get this healing and they're like engaged and married in 6 months or a year. And it's lasting. They're happily married for years and years. I mean, you see, you know, Morgan as an example. Mark has been, who we've mentioned several times today. He's, if you guys look back to the listeners, Mark Gagarin, he came on the show. I mean, he's been married 7 years. I think they have 2 kids. And yeah, I mean, we could talk so much about all this. So much fruit here. But just to kind of close it out, I mean, what kind of last things would you want to share? Kind of,
I mean, just the final thing, I mean, like, you know, reaching a point in my life where, you know, there have been several kind of moments of victory in the past 3 years that I've been clean. And it was kind of, it went from doing like whack-a-mole with my issues to doing like whack-a-mole with like the things that I was expecting, like the fruits that you were talking about to come onto my life. You know, it was after that Emerge that, you know, God completely removed the obsession to watch porn and gave me the internal strength to, you know, commit to not having sex outside of marriage. And, you know, I think those were kind of the last few things that needed to happen before he was like, look, like you are ready for the woman that I have for you.
Yeah.
And
everyone out there, they're always like, you know, I want the thing, but it's like, get ready for the thing. Just focus on that.
Yeah. I mean, God's not going to give you something that you're not ready for.
Yep.
You know, because, you know, if I was a parent and I knew that my kid couldn't ride a, you know, 250cc motorbike because he's 3 years old, like, I'm not going to give that to him as a Christmas present. Like, he's just not ready for it.
Yep.
But if I have it, what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold on to it until he's older and mature and smart. And then I'll give it to him when he's ready. Yeah. Because, you know, if God had given me my wife, I mean, even just 2 years ago, it would have ended up the exact same way that every single relationship I had been in previously had ended. You know, I would have absolutely ruined her life. And, you know, I had finally gotten to a point where I think God looked at me and he said, you know what, this one's ready. Like, he is good to go. He is the man that I want him to be for the woman I created for him. And it was actually shortly after that emerge that I met my wife.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of just this full circle moment of, you know, having these expectations, knowing where I need healing, seeking out that healing, and then, you know, receiving it, and then finally being given the things that I've been praying for.
Yeah.
For, you know, a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah. I went up to this guy at Balboa, and I was like, oh, you know, I want a wife and blah, blah, blah. And I was like asking for that. And he literally just took like half of his pointer finger, and he's like 5'2" guy, older guy, married many, many years. And he just like takes like this part of his finger, and I'm on the floor on my back.
No.
But before he knocked, and in like a good way to like lay me out and cleanse me. But before he did that, his only word to me he's like, become a husband. I'm a husband and the wife will appear. If you're watching porn, if you're, you know, abusing alcohol, if you're whatever, you know, and you know, I got this from my other friend who's married now and an awesome guy. And we were actually in the same table together when we went through the Awaken Recovery. And we were praying together. And he said this, he's like, look, you become the husband, like you don't have to become perfect. So it's like, you'll work stuff out on the other side of that. And you have that covenant and that commitment to each other, but you got it. I mean, the glaring things, you know, the addictions, the yeah. things that are just like need to get healed. Like, you work those out. You don't have to be perfect because you don't want to be like on the sidelines forever, but you don't want to go too soon out of impatience or out of that kind of codependency.
Yeah. There's definitely like a process of sanctification
yeah.
that needs to happen. You know, we're human, we're sinners. You know, I'm always going to have faults. I'm always going to have flaws. You know, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't in some way, you know, commit a sin, you know, whether it's like in a thought or, you know, maybe a word that I say. But, you know, the process is just that, you know, we become more rounded. You know, we're never going to be like this perfect, shiny sphere of, you know, like mountaintop human, right? Like, we're not going to be like the pinnacle of creation. But the beautiful thing is that, you know, God says, like, you are good enough now for someone that is good enough for you. And the beautiful thing with me and my wife is that, you know, in the areas that I struggle, she's really good. And in some of the areas that she struggles in, you know, I'm really good. So when we encounter those issues together, you know, there's always one part of our team that is, you know, fully equipped with the strength to, you know, walk us through it.
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole podcast episode.
Oh yeah. Just
that, because partner selection and kind of just picking people too similar to yourself or too much of that mirror rather than the compliment. But anyway, Christmas is coming in a couple of days and we're just going to go right through it if we keep talking.
So, yeah, of course.
No, but this is awesome. And I want to thank you obviously for coming on the show today and openly sharing your story. The reason is, inspiring, it's powerful, and it's going to provide a lot to people out there. You know, for those out there looking for freedom from addiction, looking for a healthy relationship, breaking off codependency or any of that, I'm really glad you came on the show. So thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My whole goal was just, if I can just give one person hope, you know, just share my story, if they can have an experience where they have a realization that, you know, there is a way to get better. So thank yeah. you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Brendan Burns Show. If it's your first time here, please make sure to subscribe on the Apple Podcasts app or in Spotify. Also, please leave us a rating or written review. This helps others learn about the show and spread the word to new and more people. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.